Welcome to MicroCollege. My name is Jacob Hunt. I'm the director of Thoreau College, MicroCollege here in beautiful Viroqua, Wisconsin, and the host of the MicroCollege podcast. We're speaking to you in the middle of June 2025 here in beautiful Viroqua. If you're hearing us in the next few weeks and months, check out our website and apply to the Metamorphosis Gap Semester, fall and spring semesters. We'll also be doing our summer field school coming up soon. But today we're here to talk about another project of Thoreau College, one of the offsprings, brain children of one of our alums and now staff members, and also producer of the MicroCollege podcast, Liam McGilligan. Welcome. Welcome back. You've never been really gone, but we haven't heard your voice very much recently.
I've been in the shadows over here since the third episode, so here I am speaking again. Yes.
So yeah, just Liam. Liam has been making this happen all along the last 3 years, and played all the roles at Thoreau College, from student to fellow to resident, and now staff member, the director of development for Thoreau College, and also coordinator of the Viroqua Shakespeare Festival, which is coming up soon. Tell us about the Viroqua Shakespeare Festival, Liam.
Yeah, well, we are in our fourth edition, started in 2022, and we're here in our fourth edition in June 2025. Things have just been growing so splendidly the last couple of years. We have a huge cast this year, 17 people, 8 or 9 people behind the scenes, and then another dozen and a half support staff members, other performers. So it's a really wonderful constellation of people. I think the word of mouth has grown quite well. And this year we've gotten, I think, recognition in that regard. We're operating this year with a grant from Wisconsin Humanities Council, some support from Wisconsin Public Radio, our local Temple Theater, the historic Temple Theater of Viroqua. These three entities and numerous other individuals and businesses in our area have supported the festival. We're at Prairie Wind Park this year. And the most important part, we're doing The Tempest. That is our Shakespeare play that we're doing. We also have a couple other offerings, Confessions of a Great Lakes Pirate by Tom Castle, who you may have heard on the Folk School Radio Hour if you listen to that. Tom is a Madison-based performer and maritime historian and sea shanty collector. And he has put together this one-man show about a man named Dan Seavey who terrorized the Great Lakes between about 1890 and 1930. So I'm looking forward to that. And then we've got a fun new event we're trying out with the Driftless Writing Center, the Sonnet Slam. So there'll be a poetry slam, sonnets, and people can compete for prizes. Poets can compete for prizes, best metaphor, best rhyme scheme, that sort of thing. And then there's a children's show from our local group, Wisconsin Family Theater. And there'll be food, and there'll be music, and there'll be merriment, and there'll be picnicking, and hopefully the weather cooperates, although our backup location is the Temple Theater if we do need to go indoors. So, that's the gist of it. We're here with a member of our artistic team, Stanton Davis, who's the voice coach for The Tempest. So we'll be talking to Stanton this hour, but that's the gist of this year's Viroqua Shakespeare Festival.
So just a nitty gritty here, the Viroqua Shakespeare Festival, fourth edition, 2025. This is the last weekend in June here in Viroqua. The dates are June 27th, Friday, June 27th, Saturday, June 28th, and that's when the sea shanty workshop and so forth is happening, and then Sunday, June 29th. Does it cost money?
It is free to attend. If you're in town, we highly recommend you walk or bike. It's at Prairie Wind Park. Of course, if you're coming into town, you can drive right up to Prairie Wind, the parking lot there. There's a big soccer field, and then down to your left on the hillside is our stage. It's free, and we recommend you bring a lawn chair or a blanket, maybe some plates and utensils and food to share. But no, it's free. Free to attend. Donations are welcome, though.
Yep. A really beautiful spot, and definitely worth the trip. Just classic Shakespeare in the park. If it rains, an equally beautiful venue there at the Temple Theater. Check it out on the Thoreau College, thoreaucollege.org website, also on our Thoreau College Facebook and Instagram feeds, and I think also Viroqua Shakespeare Festival also has some social media.
We're on Instagram, viroqua.shakespeare. There's also a Facebook event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sweet. So this is a really cool story, example of a Thoreau College student taking an idea and making a run for it and really making a new cultural thing and bringing interesting people to town. People like Stanton Davis.
Yeah.
Yes. Welcome, Stanton.
Thank you.
Stanton is the head of voice and speech at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Illinois, where he teaches both undergraduate and graduate acting students. He previously served in similar roles at the Temple University Theater Department and at SUNY New Paltz, where he taught voice, acting, Shakespeare, dramatic literature, and stage combat. Stanton received his MFA in acting from the University of Delaware's Professional Theater Training Program and his BFA from the University of Utah Actor Training Program. Stanton has worked professionally as an actor, stage, film, and TV commercials, fight choreographer, stagehand, director, stuntman, voice coach, dialect coach, and education director at theaters throughout the country, including the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C., the Delaware Theater Company, City Theater of Wilmington, and the First State Children's Theater in Delaware, the Berkshire Theater Festival, and the Arizona, Tucson, Southwest, Baltimore, Wisconsin, Park City, and Utah Shakespeare Festivals. And now the Viroqua Shakespeare Festival.
Yeah.
Goes on that list. And now the Viroqua Shakespeare Festival. Stanton is a member of the Independent Fight Directors Guild and is a certified associate teacher of the Fitzmaurice Voice Work.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good to think we have a voice coach here to work on how to do that. So, yes, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to Viroqua. And, yeah, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure. I'm loving Viroqua.
Great. Good to hear. So here on the podcast, we're fascinated by people's stories and biographies, and particularly their formative experiences as a young adult. So, you know, we've heard a bit about the many interesting things you've done. Where were you when you were 18, 19, 20 years old? And you know, what in that time frame set the seeds for what you've done since?
It's interesting. It kind of has its seeds a little bit earlier than that. I was a singer in a punk rock band back in the days of the original punk rock scene, and also sort of a garage rock psychedelic band. And I was singing through other people's equipment, including the amplifier for the lead guitarist. And so you basically couldn't hear me. And everybody in the band was like, you got to get a PA. You got to go out and get some microphones. And I did have a microphone, but like, get the setup, you know? And it was prohibitively expensive. And this is when I was like 15 or 16 years old. And so my mom made a deal with me that she would lend me the money if I took some acting lessons. Because she had this notion that I might really respond to that. I had always been interested in history and gone to see a lot of theater with my family. My dad was a stage manager and an actor when he was younger, like when he was in college. And my mom's family also produced the big sort of pageant shows for the Mormon faith in Utah. And my grandmother, it turns out I didn't realize at the time, actually one of her degrees was in drama, and I have her complete works of William Shakespeare with her notes in it and stuff like that. So it was kind of like coming full circle. And I had lived with my father in England for a while, and he had a deal with me that we would go to see a play a week because he really wanted me to devour theater. And what better place to do it than, you know, the West End in London, and, you know, seeing stuff at the National Theater's buildings were new at that point. And I just, you know, and then while I was there, I also saw a bunch of opera, ballets, and I think that I knew that was somewhere on my horizon, but, you know, I was the singer for this band, and I did that for like 3 or 4 years, and I had a blast and, you know, did some touring with that group, and also ended up working sound for another band out of Salt Lake City where my father had moved there, and so I toured with them. The group was called the Massacre Guys. They were a terrific group and really, 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 really sweet people. And so I knew performing arts were in the cards for me. And then when I took the acting classes, the guy who led the acting classes actually had tried to retire because he was in Chicago theater, and he moved to Arizona and couldn't stay retired. So he started a theater company, primarily to teach young actors, but also to put on productions. Mm-hmm. And he had studied at the Moscow Art Theater, but he was he was persecuted. He was of Jewish extraction, and there's a lot of, you know, anti-Semitism in Russia, and so the family left. But he had studied there at the fabled Moscow Art Theater, so he was steeped in in some really strong traditions, and I just felt like the way he taught was so inspiring, and I was like, this is what I want to do. And so I was, you know, it was career day at my high school, and somebody asked me what I wanted to do when I grew up, and I was like, I don't think I want to grow up. I mean, I might get older, but I hate the idea of stopping at a certain point, because there's more to grow old into, you know. And so I said, I think I want to be a theater. I think I want to be an actor, a professional theater person. And all the career day people were like hemming and hawing, because they had no idea what to do with that. So I ended up at one university, University of Arizona, for like a year and a half. And that was when I was 17 and 18 years old, because I started college a year early. And they didn't cast me much, and I had been playing really great roles in this other smaller, it was called Tom Thumb Players, you know. And so there was a student group that that was run by a professor in the school of it might be the college, anyway, English department, but a British guy who loved theater, specifically Shakespeare. So the first play I was ever in that wasn't a musical with the Tom Thumb Players was The Tempest, which ironically is the show that we're working on here, you know.
Back to your roots.
Yeah, and I played all the bodyguards. But, you know, the gentleman that directed that said to me at one point, he said, you really understand this language. You have a knack for this. You should keep mm-hmm. doing this. And so it just turned out that theater company, after that professor left, they became a nonprofit and moved out of being in the university, although we were still able to rehearse in university settings and stuff, because many of us were college students. But we were the ones that weren't getting cast. Mm-hmm. And so we put on Sam Shepard plays. We put on sketch comedy. We hired a local playwright to write a children's theater thing that we did. And it just gave me a ton of experience. So I was at the University of Arizona for like a year and a half, and it just wasn't training me. I just felt like I was getting better training when I was 15 from the old Russian guy, you know. And so I looked around, and it just so happened that the University of Utah at that point was a top-ranked school in the country. And and I spoke with the head of the BFA acting, who Liam knows, actually, a gentleman by the name of Kenneth Washington, who really was the one that said, obviously we want you to audition, but with this interview and your background and stuff, I think you'd be a great fit for us. Mm-hmm. And he enabled me getting into that. I mean, I'm sure I had a decent audition, but I had no idea that it was one of the top five BFA training programs in the country, largely due to Kenneth Washington, who was the sort of mentor. But there was a whole lot of other terrific teachers there, and I could not have gone to a better place because of that. And one of the big things that he did with his students is, what are you going to do when you leave the university? What are you going to do when you have to go out into the world? And so, you know, he looked at things like internships. So he got us all internships with places like Actors Theater of Louisville, and some internships with different outdoor theater festivals and things like that. And then the other one was, he had connections with so many of the top MFA actor training programs in the country. So, for example, of my class, two of the people in my class went to Juilliard. I got accepted into the National Theater Conservatory originally, and two other people got in there. And right when I was going to audition for the place that I actually ended up going to, the Professional Theater Training Program at the University of Delaware, they were in Milwaukee. And they folded in Milwaukee because there was all sorts of hoopla, and they moved the whole program, lock, stock, and barrel, to Newark, Delaware. And that program was almost entirely classical theater training. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we did a few other plays that weren't classical, but they were things like Henrik Ibsen, you know, and just like those kinds of playwrights, you know, the classics of the 19th and early 20th century. So they did a lot of great language, and that really developed for me just a love of the language. Mm-hmm. So when I got out, I just kept getting cast in Shakespeare festivals and things like that. I mean, I'd land some other theater jobs, but the other thing that really kind of kept me afloat during that time was doing television commercials and small roles in films. And so I moved back after that from Delaware back to Tucson, Arizona. And it was back when the state of Arizona really sponsored motion pictures coming into the state. Uh-huh. And they made it easy for the big motion picture companies to do that, like not having to pay the kind of taxes that you would normally have to pay, or not having to pay to, you know, like block off an entire street for several days while they filmed something, you know. And out of that, I got some really great, juicy little roles and you know, learned the, you know, how to be on film and stuff like that. And between the two of them, you know, it was quite ironic because there was one summer where I auditioned for and got in a production of, it was Halloween 5, the film Halloween 5. And I had two nights of filming. And since it was nights, you're like, it's double pay, you know. And they didn't take a break one of the nights, so there's a meal penalty. So, you know, I was looking at, I made more money in those 2 days than I did, because the rest of the summer I was working at the Utah Shakespeare Festival, which at that point was one of the top ones. It's still very highly thought of in the country. I made more money in two nights working on a film than I did the whole summer as a company member at the Utah Shakespeare Festival. You know, and I have to say that the Utah Shakespeare Festival changed my life, because it's where I made those initial professional connections with not just the other actors, but people who are designers and choreographers and folks that I'm still on conversation terms with to this very day. And it's really amazing in theater how that happens. The connections that you make, and I tell my students this all the time, you know, never abuse anybody, because theater has a long memory, you know. and to be honest, the people that work the most are the ones that are the nicest. You know, we always think, because we, you know, on television they like to hype this up, but the competitiveness between actors, and there is some of that. Mm-hmm. But what I found where the cities that I've worked in, is there's an incredible amount of support from one artist to the other. There might be a little, oh, why didn't I get that role kind of thing, but in general, the people that continually get professional gigs, I find, are the ones that are the easiest to work with. And sometimes it's just because the director wants to work with somebody they really enjoy again. And nobody's making a killing at this except for, you know, the big Hollywood folks. And so why not make a killing with people who are difficult to work with, instead of working with people that actually are decent human beings and that are fun to work with? Because we do it for the love of it. I mean, yeah, we like getting paid, but we really do it, you know, day in and day out, because it's not an easy life, you know, on the road all the time and all that sort of stuff, living out of suitcases and everything. But it's when we get together with a group of like-minded artists and get to share, you know. So like last night, we just sat at the house that Thoreau was putting us up in, and the director was there, and three of the out-of-state actors that had come in to do the show. And we just chatted and laughed, and, you know, I mean, all of a sudden we look and look, oh, it's almost 1 o'clock in the morning, and really it was just like a sharing of, yeah, and a, you know, talking about the plays and strange things that had happened to people when they were working, and, you know, like the war stories kind of thing. And that's I mean, I gotta say, that's a huge part of why I do theater. And then I think the other part is that I've also worked quite a bit in theater education. I was the education director at the Arizona Shakespeare Festival, and then at the Baltimore Shakespeare Festival. And I was teaching kids down to third grade. I was going in and, like, Midsummer Night's Dream, the war between the fairies and the pucks, and literally turned it into an etude with physicality. And then I gave them little bits of Shakespeare to do. And the parents saw it and were like totally charmed. Like, I never thought my kid could do that. He's talking Shakespeare, you know?
And amazing.
And, yeah. So anyway, that's the other side of it. That's the other leg of the three-legged stool, which is how rewarding it is to serve an audience, including young people, and really be working on the future of the art form, and being in a community where the theater is a part of the community, I think, is huge. And that's one of the reasons why I came up here for 2 days last summer. A couple of my students were, my former students, the alums of my school, were here working as professionals that they brought in from the outside. And so I told them, I said, I'd like to come up and see what that's about, maybe do a workshop. And then Liam asked me to come back, and I just like, it's, you know, as long as they'll have me, I will come back here, because all of those things, all three parts of that joined stool, really, this place ticks the boxes.
Yeah, you know. It's been, you know, it's great to hear that, like, picture of the actors, kind of, you know, community and the quality of relationships there, because that certainly resonates with the picture of the people that, you know, Liam has been bringing in these last 3 years, including your past students there, James and Gavin there, and I mean, it just it's really so the Viroqua Shakespeare Festival, you know, Viroqua is a town that has a rich kind of a arts culture,
right,
including performing
right.
arts. We've got a lot of elementary school and high school performances, a lot of community theater, a lot of people, you know, interesting little quirky things that people do.
Yeah.
The Viroqua Shakespeare Festival has some paid actors
right.
practicing a craft at high level, which has been, I think, really eye-opening for a lot of local people as
mm-hmm.
well. And it's been a delight to get to know people and just to see people, like, you know, you can tell, like, your story, what stands out about it to me after having asked this question for 3 years now. A lot of the stories that lead to people to do things, and these are people who are teachers or they're people who are starting, you
right.
know, like micro colleges and experiments in higher education. But many of them are like, I didn't know what I was going to do. I went backpacking in South America and I wandered around. But you found a vocation, right?
Right.
Like very early on, like, and you've been able to practice this in many different ways, but like really a golden thread up to this moment.
Yeah. You know, and again, I mean, you know, for as much as people sometimes still love to blame their parents for things, before my father passed away, he saw me playing Leontes in The Winter's Tale at the Arizona Shakespeare Festival the year before he passed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he came down and he's like, you know, he was just incredibly moved by the experience and like, you really know your stuff, you know? And we were rehearsing something else, and so, you know, he graduated from Harvard Law School, and so he's not shy to heavy duty workloads, but between all the rehearsals and then performing and stuff like that, he was like, you people in the theater work harder than anybody
yeah.
I know, you know. And it really does feel like that sometimes, but because there's such a love for it, that I think that and adrenaline get us through.
Yeah. So your specialty is voice and speech,
right?
Can you tell us about that? Like, what are you working on when you're doing? You're a voice coach or working voice and speech?
Well, that's cool because that actually kind of landed me the job teaching at university. And I do teach some acting classes and I teach stage combat because I was a fencer way before I was a stage combat person. You know, I was taking fencing lessons at age 8. My parents, I guess, just indulged all these weird proclivities. You know, I'm an equine sports enthusiast now, and my first horseback riding lessons were at 9. But, you know, thankfully, all of these things pointed towards being a theater artist, and it was unclear where that was going to sustain for me. And I, you know, when I was between gigs, sometimes I'd end up back at my folks' place and, you know, can I sleep in the extra bedroom for a month between gigs? You know, things like that. And I was talking to my voice teacher from University of Delaware, and she was kind of, she still is, she's alive, and she's kind of internationally known now. Her name's Catherine Fitzmaurice. And I was on the phone with her because she was teaching with two people from the British Academy of Dramatic Arts and from the Royal Shakespeare Company, the voice teachers from them. And she was teaching with them in at Arizona State in Tempe. And I went to the workshop, and so she found out that I was using her techniques with the theater company that I was working with, because they're like, you know how to give people a good warm up. And then they were like, can you take some notes too? And, you know, it just it sort of fell into the educational thing. And so I told Catherine about it, and she's like, your eyes light up when you talk about teaching, you know? And so like several months later, she's like, you can't be happy just doing Renaissance fairs and you know, that sort of thing. And nothing to say bad about Renaissance fairs. I learned a lot about comedy from performing at them. But she's like, I think that you would really thrive, and you have an aptitude for hearing the sounds of people's voices.
Yeah.
And so she was getting together and doing her first two certification classes. And so I was in the second of her certification classes, and she cut me a huge break on the price because I was a former student and she wanted me to to get the certification. And then while I was there getting the certification, she had me out to lunch with another one of the people that was doing it. And I had no idea at the time, but it was actually a job interview. and so then that other woman calls me up and is like, I'm leaving my position, but we want to fill it with somebody that has the same background that I do. And she's like, I think you're really gifted and you bring a really strong sense of the classical works and stuff like that too. And she was a teacher, she was the voice person and one of the acting teachers at State University of New York at New Paltz. And I went up and interviewed, and I loved it. I loved the other teachers and everything. And so that was my first professional gig as a university teacher. And then 9/11 happened, mm-hmm. and there was a hiring freeze in the state, and I had only been hired for like 2.5 years. And so when that contract was up, I directed a show there in the summer with local actors and some equity contracts and mm-hmm. stuff like that. But when it was over, that was it. And so I called up Catherine Fitzmaurice, and I was like, "So, any other people looking for a voice teacher?" And she's like, sure enough, one of the master teachers, Donna Snow, who taught at Temple University, they needed a new person to teach speech primarily, but they also knew I could teach stage combat and a few other things. And so I came down for an interview, and they hired me on the spot. And so, and Philadelphia is a very different scene because, you know, New Paltz reminds me a lot of Viroqua. It's uh-huh. very artsy. There's a lot of outdoor things to do and stuff like that. And then I moved from that to the center, like inner city Philadelphia, mm-hmm. you know. But the theater there was outstanding. A lot of my students have gone on to have major careers that I had there. I was there for 5 years. I guess I didn't quite answer part of it, which is the Fitzmaurice voice work is based on the work of Cecily Berry and also goes all the way back to the Bel Canto opera of mm. the 19th century. And when I finally ended up landing at Northern Illinois University, I finally got to meet somebody who really taught Bel Canto. And so he and I taught summer workshops together with actors and with opera singers. And from both ends, working at the anatomy of the physicality of how to produce sound.
Yeah.
Right. You know, because I'm a voice teacher, but I'm not a singing teacher. But the one thing that he was always trying to work against with the opera singers, he's like, I can't stand park and bark, where you go out on stage and plant your feet and deliver your aria and then you're off. You know, he's like, it's lifeless.
Yeah.
And so the bel canto breathes life into opera because the whole idea is that each of the breaths imbues you with a new experience and a new, in actor terms, a new objective to play, to get mm-hmm. at the essence of what you're trying to achieve in the scene with the other characters and so on. And so when I came here, the first thing I did is I worked on what is the anatomy of breathing, you know, how do the intercostal muscles between the ribs, how does that help you with breathing, the diaphragm, the release of the transverse abdominis, which is the deepest set of core muscles in your core, all of that, so that you can get a big deep breath and then have air under it that you don't have to strain in your throat and mm-hmm. lose your voice to get across to an audience. And quite frankly, it's almost necessary to have some set of skills like that in an outdoor theater. And I'm still at work with some of the people, but you know, last night we did a stumble through, and I was like really happy at how much of it that I could hear, and I've only been here like 5 days. I know many of them are trained actors already, but yeah. It's like, this is not going to be the problem I thought it was going to be. And in that sense, it's the mechanics, but then she, with the Fitzmaurice voice work, always rewinds that back into the actor experience. And so the breath is because there's a need to do something. It's like that moment where the light bulb goes on over your head. And, you know, and so what I keep working with them on is every time there's a punctuation, it's like a new little thought. It's like a new micro objective or action that you're playing, to put it into actor terms. And it changes from one to the next. And so playing with that gives a artistic palette for the actors to broaden, to think in terms of this one, I'm establishing something and then I'm knocking it down over here. So we look at the punctuation with several of the actors that I've worked with individually. We've also looked at the spellings and the Shakespeare's folios and quartos, the original spellings from that were around. Well, the quartos were around, you know, while he was still alive.
Before they invented spelling.
Right. But basically, he signed his own name like 9 different ways, you know. So, but, and then, of course, the folios were based on his actors after he died. They went back in and collected all of them. And so you can sort of look at those as a reference point as to what Shakespeare wanted, because he would do things like words that were important had longer spellings. Uh-huh. Like he'd have a word like this with an E at the end of it. That doesn't mean that you say thice. It's just that this is an operative word. And so living a little bit longer inside it, you know. Capitalizing words in the middle of sentences that aren't proper nouns. You know, why is that word capitalized? Because that wants to pop. And so constantly looking at those little, I call them like messages from beyond the grave, you know, because it's literally what Shakespeare intended to give his actors.
And the actors, right? If they're the ones recording these passing these on.
Right.
Yeah.
And absolutely, you know, I think that the longest rehearsal time they ever had was 2 weeks. Basically, they've been able to determine that by looking at the schedule for the season and what plays performed when. And, you know, I say to my students, imagine playing Hamlet after 2 weeks of rehearsal. You know, I mean, but there was no director. And so the playwright put all the hints for, mm-hmm. you know, the meter of the piece, iambic pentameter, you know, and like da-dum, 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 da-dum. But what happens when you get da-dum in there too, you know? And it's like a rim shot in jazz. It syncopates, and Shakespeare syncopates to help the sense and the meaning of the words. So getting modern actors to feel that, you know? And then also the punctuation, because there weren't any rules about punctuation in Shakespeare's day either. So he punctuated as a hint to the actors, you know, this is, you need to take a breath here, or you need to, this it's a new thought. He didn't do it because there were rules about how to spell or write well, you know, because the words were spelled all sorts of different ways inside them, you know. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, a lot of editors have gone back and standardized all of that, which means
cleaned it up.
Yeah, they cleaned it up, which means they've taken away all the advantages to actual theater artists that could be gleaned. And really, so many of the modern texts for Shakespeare are really kind of more for academics than they are for practicing professionals, you know? And so the professionals prefer to have the long and weird spellings and the capitalizations and odd punctuation and all those kinds of things, because you can hang your hat on that in terms of performance and ask, now, why is that way? And that can help inform the action that your character is playing. So that's the kind of stuff that I'm working with them. And frankly, a lot of it with some of them is going to just be making sure they don't lose their voice because of the outdoor space.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a vocal health portion to the work, too.
Yeah. Fascinating. And it should be mentioned, you know, the Verroca Shakespeare Festival, it's a mixed cast, right? We have some professionals, people with lots of training, lots of, you know, professional experience, as well as local kind of community theater actors and young people, like youth actors as well.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting mixed group of people.
And I actually really love that. I think that in reality, I think that's the way people used to get training, is starting out as absolute beginners in small roles and watching what the other people are doing that are kind of moving up the chain, you know, and eventually then you start walking into bigger and bigger roles. But I love that sense of, and you know, of, it's sort of like collaborative leadership, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But I should also say that there's quite a few of the actors that are from, you know, southwestern Wisconsin here that are not the ones that were brought in from out of state, but that are incredibly talented. Yeah. And so, you know, like the guy who's playing Stefano is just he's a treat to listen to on the stage. And it is really one of the funniest things in the play. do you know what I mean? He's a local guy, but oh my goodness,
I think, you know, one of the beautiful things about this Shakespeare Festival and other things that we do as Thoreau College and the Driftless Folk School, is we bring, you know, opportunities for, we were raising, you know, the local level of all of these things. We, you know, people like you come in and teach skills, and those get into the local culture. And I know my daughters, my My 9 and 12 year olds last year were part of the Henry V last year, and just delighted. You know, it was such a powerful theater experience for them, even the little parts that they had, because they were able to work with these incredible, like, you know, masters, and they will carry that into their, you know, they do plays every year at the Waldorf School here, and so they're able to put those to work right away.
Yeah, that really is cool. I feel that when you expose people to heightened language, crafted language, that it rearranges your brain.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it's a thing, you know, when I was studying at the University of Utah, we had a program where we would go and work with people in the state penitentiary.
Yeah.
And also when I was at Baltimore, we did residencies at these really, really tough inner city schools where they literally would lock you in the building after you got there, you know? Huh. And so many of those folks, you can just see the response to that. It rearranges the way you think about reality and how communication works. And not everything you say has to be literal, but that there's figurative speech and poetry that can exist in the modern everyday. But Shakespeare, my friend Alex Gelman, who I teach with, he's a Russian film and television and stage director. But, you know, he talks about Shakespeare being the thing to awaken the dead ear. Because once it's been awakened, people start getting hungry for it,
right?
You know, and they notice the wonderful storytelling that's behind all that poetry, you know?
Yeah. I mean, as a teacher, I've taught Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet and things in high schools, and there is something, you know, it's so common for people to say, I don't understand Shakespeare, the language is beyond me on the page. And then you take them to a well-done performance, or they participate in one, and it's like, oh, wow, this is amazing. I understand it right away, right? And because and I think the work that you are doing with, you know, to making the language come alive,
right?
And you know, looking at that level of the punctuation and the meter and all of that is essential to that,
right? I mean, we certainly don't look at that stuff to be academically right. We're like, oh yes, it's a trochaic pentameter. You know, we use them because, frankly, there's so much embedded in it that if the actor knows that, that can give them the meaning for the character and give them a deeper experience of the scenes and the role, the entirety of the role. So it's one of those things where a lot of people think that they're not going to understand it, you know. And I've come up against this since I went, you know, when I was in college and like inviting friends to come see me in my first play, which was The Tempest. Do you know what I mean? And everybody that I've talked to, if it's done well, there are some words you don't get, you know? But what I try to explain to those people is Shakespeare made up thousands of words. And so
that's one of the ones that didn't stick.
Right. Well, but also, if you think about it, it meant that people in his day didn't know exactly what people were saying. It was the feel of the words and the intent behind them. So if they're well acted, you get the story. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I just came back from doing a study abroad program with some of the students from NIU. In Turkey and Greece, and so we went to an international theater festival, and there was plays. They saw plays in Italian, Dutch, Turkish, obviously, and one other language. But anyway, the point being that that there were no super titles, or if there were super titles, they were in Turkish. They weren't in English, you know, and so. But the students were so surprised at how well we'd read a synopsis before the show, so we kind of knew. But like how well they understood simply by the quality of the storytelling, you know, the design, amazing. the choreography, the intent and emotional depth of the sounds of the words in and of themselves, they're the storytelling. You know what I mean? And so people think they need to know what every word means, and I'm like, not everybody knew what Shakespeare was saying, even in his own day, you know? But if the actor is good, they can lean into certain words or languages. So there's an instance that I use with my students, which is there's this word at the beginning of The Winter's Tale, and Leontes is going crazy, and he's talking about his wife, and he uses the metaphor that his pond is sluiced by his neighbor. By Sir Smile, his neighbor. And first of all those S's, it makes it sound like something scythering and slithering or something like that. Alliterative knitting, it's called, a rhetorical form. But also, who knows what sluicing is? I had to look it up, and I was like, oh, that's when you mine for gold and you go through the mud and you try to pull out the valuable stuff. That's a sluice box. And so I get that the word sluice had a broader meaning in Shakespeare's day. But if you say that word sluiced, you know, the audience goes, I don't know what that is, but it's bad. You know what I mean? And so a lot of the words, because they have an onomatopoeic value, mm-hmm. they sound like what they are. And if you can lean into that, so much of the language becomes understandable, because it's all in the context of what they understand about the conflict in the scene and who the characters are. And so all that stuff that actors do to craft it, and directors pushing them in different directions and opening up possibilities for them. The director for the show, Greta, is really terrific at that, like giving the actors the opportunity to bring some of themselves into it. And that's what makes the characters come alive. And so, that's the thing, is that you can get it. You know,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think people will have a really great ride with this one too. I was just super heartened by seeing the stumble through last night, because I think it's going to be a terrific show.
Yeah, The Tempest is such a crowd pleaser.
Yeah, yeah.
Wonderful characters there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and it's later. It's a later one of Shakespeare's plays. And people even say that there's a speech in it that Prospero says about the nature of reality that is kind of his farewell to the theater. I mean, he wrote two or three other plays after that, mm-hmm. but the We Are Such Stuff as Dreams Are Made On,
yeah.
Really is this, it, you know, it's almost like this Zen Buddhist sort of, like this existential realization that what really matters in the world aren't all the emerald towers and all that kind of stuff, but that they're the decency and the relationships that you take forward with yourself. All the other things go away, you know, and leave not a rack behind, as Prospero says.
So, I mean, that maybe is a good lead in. I mean, you know, Shakespeare, you know, you've devoted much of your life to bring Shakespeare alive, to, you know, working with people of a lot of different ages, you know, representing these different characters. You know, what is it that keeps us coming back to Shakespeare? What does an engagement with Shakespeare bring to a modern person?
You know, it's funny, but a lot of times people, you know, that don't know this will say, well, why are we still doing Shakespeare? And I'm like, you know that there's at least one Shakespeare festival of some kind in every state in the United States. In many, there's five or six even, you know. So I say to people, it's summer stock theater that young people can get cast in and begin to be trained in, you know. So you walk out of school, do some summer stock Shakespeare. But that's just because there's a demand for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's because it was designed as a medium to be shared with an audience. And so audiences feel a little bit like they're on the home team, watching their team up there on stage, like watching the Green Bay Packers. Do you know what I mean? I mean, literally, they feel like they have some investment in it. And because the audience gives energy to the stage and back and forth, and we don't pretend that they're not there, you know, a lot of theater that isn't Shakespeare is like fourth wall, where nobody really takes in the audience.
Right.
But boy, they do in Shakespeare. And I think one of the reasons why audiences really like children's theater and musical theater and storytime theater and Shakespeare is because it consciously engages the audience. And then the people feel like that they're a part of the production. And that's exciting. You know, they do it in musicals. They sit and they stop and they sing to the audience what's going on in their head, but they're sharing it with the audience.
Yeah.
That's like a Shakespeare soliloquy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? And so I think that, you know, and the same thing happens in children's theater. Hi, boys and girls, you know, and stuff like that. And that's exciting, and you can't get it in the sensation of doing film. I mean, there's so much that's great about doing film and television. I won't cut those down, but the live experience, people are still hungry for it. I also think some of it is a little bit of a nostalgia for a time that we can see through rose-colored glasses, but, you know, because the themes that are wrestled with in Shakespeare are so universal. I mean, this mm-hmm. play is about leadership and the failures of leadership of several of the main characters, about revenge, about forgiveness, and these are some things, and about honor and a lack of honor and stuff, mm-hmm. and those are big, huge personality things to grapple with, and I feel sometimes, I mean, you know, you're not going to get that watching My Three Sons. Do you know what I mean? But because the characters have these really deep moral quandaries. And even in the comedies, I mean, this is a comedy, but at the core of it, there's a man who's exacting revenge by raising a storm on all his enemies, and he gets them on the island. And then slowly his spirit helps teach him, and then meeting the son of his enemy and seeing like how amazingly he's come to life and strangely stood the test, as Prospero says, that he discovers his humanity, you know. And then also because of the forgiveness, the power of that allows the king that he had that had crossed him originally to be forgiven and to gladly give his son to this guy's daughter who earlier almost killed them. What I mean? And so, yeah, it's comedy, but at the heart of it is this emotional journey that has to do with morality, decency, and all those kinds of like old-fashioned notions or ideas. But I think they really speak to a modern audience, still speak to them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Beautiful. Yeah. Liam, do you have? I know you have some questions.
Well, actually, all my questions I think kind of already got rifled through, but I still got the word. The word sluiced. It got this other word stuck in my head that I've been thinking about, you know, for the last 5-10 minutes now. We do this thing in the winter for the last 3 winters here called the Bardathon, and I bet this happens in other places. I know it happens at the Fairbanks Shakespeare Theater in Alaska, right. Which Colin Thielen, he's participated in the Fairbanks Shakespeare Theater, and a couple of other of our cast members have. But we do this thing called the Bardathon, where it's a 24/7 for 7 days straight. Complete
wow.
works, marathon reading.
Oh my God!
And we did it this last winter, and it's just a psychedelic experience. Uh-huh. I mean, and I just remember it's so crazy. Like you were saying, like what was it that Gelman said that Shakespeare makes the dead ear alive?
Yeah, to awaken the dead ear.
And I just remember, like, you know, so many experiences with Shakespeare, I've had that, but I just remember this last winter, we were reading Henry V, the uncut text, and this word that I've never heard before, and the way the guy said it, it was, how churiginally, which you probably have sounded like gibberish to you, but it was about like a surgeon, and just but he like just lengthened the R's and 2.5 hours into the reading, so we're kind of like drunk on these words, and
it happens.
And this word, I was just like, we paused the reading for like 30 seconds to just laugh at this word and the way he delivered it. So I've just been thinking about churiginally. And it's amazing how a new word can floor you, or a word you've heard many times when it's delivered in a certain way, or just can kind of like floor you and open up new meanings. That's what I've been thinking about for the last 10 minutes.
And if you give that experience to young actors, or even like kids in like grade school, when they hear words they've never heard before or used in a context that they aren't used in now, I think it opens doors, just like being in the presence of the poetry and the imagery in the poetry, but the words themselves. You know, once you start learning what some of those things are, it just opens your horizons, you know? So when I was at the Baltimore Shakespeare Festival, one of the things that we did is that some of the students had done our produced shows that we would go into schools and produce a Shakespeare with the students at the school. But out of those, we selected like 4 or 5 kids to actually go on tour with the Equity Company. And, you know, at the end of that, several of them were like, this is the biggest thing that's ever happened to me in my life. And, you know, it transforms people, you know? And that feels good as an artist to literally do something that's of service. And you can do it chirurgically, or you can sluice your way through it or whatever. But in the end, those words help to awaken that dead ear and also help to expand the knowledge horizons too, you know? So
I mean, our vocabulary, our language is so tightly woven to our consciousness and our ability to think. And with Shakespeare, I think one of the reasons that Shakespeare is perennial is because he was the midwife of the modern English language, many of those words and turns of phrase. So it's such a common experience to be, you know, watching a performance of a play or reading a play in Shakespeare. It's like, oh, that can that's there too, like an image or a word or something like that. And it is, you know, it is important sort of origin story for, you know, our language and therefore for ability to think and be.
It's funny because a lot of times I've heard from students, you know, I used to teach this like 100 level for non-majors introduction to theater class, and people would say, I just don't understand all that old English. And I'm like, wait a minute, old English sounds more like Danish, right?
Gary Beowulf,
and Middle English is like Danish and French mixed together. And it was only modern English within 30 years back before Shakespeare's birth. And if you go back further, you were literally back in Middle English. Mm-hmm. You know, you're in the language of Chaucer. And that most English speakers will pick up about 60% of, you know. That's why they still translate Chaucer, even though in theory it's Middle English, but it sure as heck ain't Old English. And that's like Beowulf, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's important, and I try to remember this to people all the time, is that, no, Shakespeare is modern English. It's early modern English, and there are some uses that have fallen out over the years, and some words that completely have fallen out over the years, you know, like a word like proud. In Shakespeare's day, proud was not a good thing. Mm-hmm. Proud was one of the seven deadly sins. Right. And so when you put that in the middle of a line, I have to sort of stop and go, we need to color the word proud so the audience gets that this is the kind of foolish pride that people can have. Not that you're like a content with your place in society and mm-hmm. that you're proud of it, like in that sense, but that you're proud because you're petty and that you're proud because you've committed the sin of like assuming that you're better than other people. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's an example of a word where the usage is some of them have fallen away and others haven't. But certainly over 400 odd years, words are going to come and go and meanings are going to shift and change. And Lord knows spellings do. You know, look at the original spellings. it can be mental gymnastics for a while until you get used to reading those scripts, you know.
Yeah, and not just modern English, but also modern people, right?
Right.
I think it's been argued, and you know, I think really convincingly, these characters, these great Shakespearean characters, you know, Hamlet and Othello and Falstaff mm-hmm. and Prospero, I would say, these are people who are we can recognize our inner lives in a way. And so when we did the first Verroqua Shakespeare Festival, one of the very earliest podcast interviews was with the Willie Jones, who was the director for that show, one of the creators.
Right.
And I asked him who his favorite character was, mm-hmm. and he answered Richard III. Right.
Wow.
And like, and so and part of the story that there was, you know, this is a person, if you can embody a person who's got that kind of malignancy and your goal is to make that person understandable, legible to an audience, like that's a powerful act. And Shakespeare does that over and over again with all kinds of characters.
Yeah. He tries to write villains, but he constantly writes villains that are some of the most three-dimensional characters that he's written.
Right.
You know, Shylock was supposed to be a villain, and yet Shakespeare gives him this amazing speech about racism and bigotry and all that stuff. You know, hath not a Jew eyes, hath the, you know, but he's still the guy that's trying to murder somebody else in the play. But somehow or another, Shakespeare just can't write a two-dimensional character. And so it's incumbent upon you, if you're playing Richard III, that you find the vulnerability and that inner squishiness that everybody has, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. So what's your answer to that question? Who's your favorite character?
I think it's been, for a long time, it's been Sir John Falstaff in the Merry Wives, and that's clearly him in a different period of writing, but certainly the Henry IV, Part 1 and Part 2. He's funny. He's tragic. He's amazing word craft, and there's some scenes in it. When I was younger, I was lucky enough to play Prince Hal opposite this wonderful actor that was playing John Falstaff, and the rhetorical battles between those two characters, you know, Hal gets the best of him sometimes, but there's a lot of times where Falstaff walks away going in your face, Prince, you know. he's just the use of language in those scenes is just it's almost heroic. It's so ridiculously funny and yet rich, you know, and moving in some places, you know, as he admits that he's old and, you know, and he has the young wench from the bar, and he basically tells her that he's old, and she's like, no, you're not old, you know, but like, you know, I thought that, you know, that's incidental, but you know, as you start getting older yourself, when a character says, I am old, and admits it to other people, there is a real vulnerability in that. And you have to find that as Falstaff, because it's easy just to fall into the humor because he's so friggin' funny. Mm-hmm. But underneath all that is a man who kind of has failed at so much in his life, and he's feeling that he's feeling his mortality. And you get that in that character. Anyway, that's probably my favorite Shakespeare character.
Yeah, common answer. And wow, what an amazing figure. Yeah. I think also underlines, you know, Shakespeare, and The Tempest does as well, like this... Like, is it, you know, there's so much humor, so much comedy, mm-hmm. in it, but also so much, like, pathos as well, so much death. Yeah.
One interesting thing that I think about The Tempest is it's the only play that Shakespeare wrote that was an entirely original idea. Uh-huh. Because Shakespeare borrowed heavily from, like, Boccaccio and from the Plutarch, Holinshed's Chronicles of England and stuff like that. And so, but The Tempest was his own creation. They think that he based some of the descriptions of it on descriptions of Bermuda and mm-hmm. the colonization of Bermuda and sort of the plight of the being colonized. And so you actually see that in both Caliban and in Ariel, that it's the colonizer that comes in. And really, in the end, he leaves the island and he surrenders up those powers back to them. And he finds the humility and the wisdom to allow Caliban to grow into whatever the island's going to make of him. And so in that way, it's just lovely in that way because of that that cutting edge sword of the humanity on one side and then the super, super funny on the other side, and navigating back and forth between those. And the fact that that was the one play that Shakespeare was just like, I'm going to make something up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, again, that's also, like, that's something very modern about that, right? There is, you know, that, you know, if you go back in literature, right, we're just, you know, this is a mythology, this is the Bible, mm-hmm. this is historical events that we're recording. So yeah. This is just a story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Powerful. So I guess also, you know, working as you have as an educator, working with students, you know, within festivals and in universities and you know, this recent trip to Turkey and Greece, I guess I'm wondering, you know, one of the things here at Thoreau College, we the arts are one of our five pillars, and you know, we do visual arts, we do folk arts and crafts, we do singing, and we also do theater. And so I'm wondering if you have any insights for us about, so let's say, you know, most of our students are not coming in as people who are thinking of themselves as future actors. They maybe don't have any theater background at all. But, you know, working with voice, working with you know, movement, stage combat, things like that, and just working with drama, what does that bring to a liberal arts education or a general education?
Awakening the dead ear. You know, it's funny. I have a really good friend who she just finished her PhD in English, and she's my age. So it's starting a second career. But one of the jobs that they had her do as part of her fellowship was teaching the rhetoric class. You know, and I was like, "Do you teach any actual rhetoric?" And she just, "No, we teach people to write." Mm-hmm. But, you know, she knows full well, as I do, that rhetoric was meant to be spoken.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's why in Shakespeare's day they said, will you hear this play? Because they wanted to hear the language. And somehow or another, in the bringing forth these complex and deep, deep characters and situations, you gain an appreciation, not just of the language, but of the subtleness of character. Because that's stuff that you can translate into any profession, you know. So many people that I know that started as actors have then gone on to be, you know, company managers at a festival or head sales directors somewhere because, you know, people that sell stuff have to use convincing language, hence rhetoric. Do you know what I mean? But there's so many things that can be gleaned from a good theater education that apply in so many different ways. One of the students that went on this trip with us was an anthropology major and a theater minor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, her understanding of all the archaeological stuff was amazing, but she wanted to see where the interface with that was with the Ottoman and Turkish culture and then the Roman and Lydian and Greek cultures before that, you know. And putting all that together, the experience of going and doing that with a bunch of theater people was really profound for her, you know, because they have a slightly different perspective on it. But at the same time, I think it's one of the reasons why people still go to the theater, because it speaks to so many different levels. So that if you're involved in doing it, it's a collaborative art form. And as a collaborative art form, you have to find ways to compromise. You have to find ways to not judge or do vindictive things, because again, the people that you work with are going to be, you'll run into them again and again and again throughout your career. So, but like, you know, I have so many people that I know, like for example, my farrier that cuts my horse's hooves. He's like, I did theater all through high school. He's like, it was one of my favorite things that I did in high school. He's like, now I'm a horseshoer, you know, but seriously, I've heard that so many times from people. It's like that was one of their favorite things that they did, because that sense of camaraderie, the sense of pulling together for one purpose,
yeah,
you know. And so it's not just the actors, but it's also the designers and the people that work on the crews and that, you know, help to dress people and, you know, make the costumes or compile the costumes and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, stage management is probably one of the hardest things that anybody does in the theater. And oftentimes people that study stage management end up in other professions. You know, I know somebody that became an air traffic controller. It was a stage manager. But if you think about it, it's
keep
kind of the same
colliding
thing. You're calling cues, except it's a little bit more life or death.
Yeah, that resonates with my experience. I've been a teacher my whole life. I've not been a director or anything like that. But, you know, I did a lot of theater in high school and in college. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the two things that I did in that, you know, to that have prepared me the most to be a teacher, these theater experiences, whether it's, you know, putting on, we did here, you know, 4.5 hour long performance of Goethe's Faust.
Oh my goodness, how cool. See, but I'd be the guy driving up here to watch that.
And, you know, improv, we did Japanese no plays,
oh,
like
cool.
We did all kinds of, you know, really fun stuff. And then the other thing was working with horses, mm-hmm. horses and cattle, like large animals. And
right.
So, and there is something about, you know, getting back on the horse, you know,
yeah.
And the same thing with like, yeah, you miss your line, you know, crap, like, what do you do there? And
right.
You're working with the team to put things together, and that experience of bringing it to an audience is something that that, you know, every class is a little play, right? If you're, you know, and then at the core of it is the language, right?
Right.
Your words, if you're speaking, if you're giving a presentation, a lecture, you're asking questions, can you make those words live? And
right.
And then therefore the content will live.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting. I was able to, when I first started going to Turkey, I was able to go over there and direct a production with a professional cast in Ankara. And one of the things that I learned, and they don't do that as much here because of unions and whatever else. I mean, there's some great things about unions, but the designers and even the people that are running the backstage elements were required to be at the rehearsals.
Uh-huh.
So that by the time the show opened, they didn't really need somebody to call the cues for them, because they knew the show.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after the show was over, they'd go and have a cup of coffee with you and talk about what you were doing and stuff like that. So in that sense, it's something that I think we have lost, because it's become too balkanized in the country. And the fact that it was really, really nice to be where there's professional actors, you know, the composer would be there at least 4 days of the week.
Mm-hmm.
The lighting designer, the scenic designer, you know, he came in and he was like, those boats, I was directing Moby Dick there. And I did an adaptation of it and then helped with the translation into Turkish. It was really cool. But, you know, the final scene is them on the whaling boats chasing the Moby Dick after they finally find him. And the boats didn't work. I mean, they just were not moving around the stage. And I had this hotshot movement coordinator that they had brought in to work with. And both of us were like, I don't know what we're going to do about those boats. The next day, all those guys that were watching that happen stayed up all night and welded entirely new boats.
Wow.
Yeah. And I got back to the theater and I'm like, where did these come from? They're perfect. And the designer's like, oh, we all stayed up overnight and we made them. Just like,
awesome.
It's nothing, you know?
Yeah.
But that is the nature oftentimes of what it feels like to do theater. It's like, I want it to be good. And I know that if the boats don't work, the end of the play is not going to be great. You know,
yeah.
Especially if it's supposed to be these guys in these boats doing battle with a whale, you know. So,
and you go also, I mean, I was also recently in that region, Greece and Turkey, and, you know, go to the Aegean there, and you're reminded of the roots of theater you go to the Parthenon, in Athens, in the sacred precinct, there is a theater there, Apollodorus,
Delphi has a theater too, where the oracle is.
As well as athletics, right? Mm-hmm. Like the theater and sports come out of sacred ritual,
right?
And these are profoundly spiritually significant kind of sites, and there is something I think that a production, especially the people putting on the production, really can experience.
It's so much of it. We would be pointing out to the students, because we took them to all these ancient theaters, but we also were like, okay, so that right up there on that mound, that's Zeus's altar. That's where the Judgment of Paris took place before the Trojan War. And there's literally a place where in the mythology, the people, that's where it took place. Yep. You know what I mean? At one point, Portia which play is it? Anyway, she talks about the Dardanian wives, and it's like, it's like, this is so obscure, but the Dardanian wives are, because the area of the Dardanelles, which is the straits that kind of go to Istanbul and then into the Black Sea, that the Dardanelles are the Dardanian people that live there, and we're going through that area and on the bus, and I'm like, okay, this is where the Dardanian wives are. That's a quote from Shakespeare, but the world out over there is just full of those kinds of places.
Yeah, layer upon layer.
And to the point where when I went to, I didn't go to Troy with this group of people, but there's like 9 cities of Troy,
right?
And you dig down further and further, then there's another city, it's like amazing,
So those are deep down roots in the whole civilization. So we're so honored and privileged to have you with us for this event and the whole Faroque Shakespeare Festival.
It's been a real pleasure, and I hope people realize what they have here, because this is a special group of people that are doing this work, and I'm really privileged to be a part of it. And so I can just tell you that if you're audience and you're thinking, well, should I go this or not, this is going to be a terrific show.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.